It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the FDA approved a drug that could help slow cognitive decline and improve brain function for people in the early stages of Alzheimer's. A doctor joins us for a look at the potential benefits and some concerns. First, after a rocky week of voting repeatedly on who would replace Democrat Nancy Pelosi as Speaker, House Representatives and new Speaker Kevin McCarthy opened this week by targeting the Internal Revenue Service. With their first policy vote after getting a slim majority in the House, Republicans introduced a bill that would rescind more than $70 billion in funding for the IRS over the next 10 years. That's out of a total of $80 billion that Congress approved for the agency as part of the Inflation Reduction Act passed last year. The Democratic-controlled Senate probably won't take up that bill, but the move in the House demonstrates a priority to cut funding for the federal tax agency. It may not be the last attempt of its kind. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the current funding level, staffing level, capacity of the Internal Revenue Service? Do you support stripping some of that new IRS funding away? Do you think it should hold on to what it's been given? Have you interacted with the IRS lately, tried to call in, say, did you get an answer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephen Rosenthal is a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. He researches, speaks, and writes on a range of federal income tax issues with a focus on business taxes. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to be here.
Let's talk about this funding that's in stake. We've talked about it a little bit in the past, this Inflation Reduction Act money that went to the IRS. What was it supposed to do?
Well, that money was supposed to bolster the IRS's efforts both to serve taxpayers and to enforce the tax law, about half and half. The IRS needed a whole bunch of modernization, and they also needed a lot of personnel replacement because the IRS workforce is aging. And, you know, interestingly enough, the IRS has been loaded with more and more responsibilities over the last decade or so, with less and less budget. So it needed help.
There's been talk of adding 87,000 new IRS employees. In calling for this funding cut, employees cross that out, replace it with agents. Republicans say 87,000 agents are being added under this funding. Can you sort out that distinction for us?
Well, there's a lot of mythology around the 87,000 number. At least you didn't say the 87,000 would be armed and packing. Mm-hmm. But the 87,000 includes customer service reps, tech workers, as well as agents. Only about half of the money would be going to enforcement side of things. And so I would imagine far fewer than the 87,000 would go for enforcement. And only about 3% of IRS agents are special agents with guns. And so I think the images conjured up of a new force of IRS agents running roughshod over taxpayers is exaggerated.
Let's talk about some of the problems the funding was supposed to help solve. First of all, backlogs with the IRS. I mentioned I invited people to say if they'd had trouble reaching the IRS. I did. I had a kind of a basic question, and it took a lot of phone calls. What are we seeing when it comes to backlogs with taxpayers trying to call in, tax preparers trying to call in, and not always getting through?
Well, backlogs have been a disaster. Unopened mail has been a disaster. Tax refunds. People have waited years for refunds. The IRS is making some progress to reduce the backlog reported today, and I expect that progress will be accelerated with more money. The IRS is already spending some of that money, part of the $80 billion, for this next year, this 2023 audit season. And so, tax return season. And so I think we've seen some help, and we'll see more in the months to come and presumably in the years to come as well. But it's been a real problem. That's the service element of Internal Revenue Service. Of course, there's also the enforcement element.
We're talking to Steve Rosenthal from the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C., looking at IRS funding, some new funding from the Inflation Reduction Act. House Republicans voted to cancel much of that funding. Symbolic mostly because the Senate probably won't. There could be efforts in the future, though. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Joe is with us in Eau Claire. Joe, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My main concern with funding being stripped away is the inability to enforce large corporations paying their fair share of taxes. When we consider the infrastructure, whether that's roads, schools, and any number of public, transportation options, all of the things that our tax money goes to support, we continue to hear of these large corporations that are not paying taxes. And so my main concern, if this funding were to go away, is, is that even a viable thing to hold these large corporations accountable? That's just my comment, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Joe, thanks for the call. Steve, you just mentioned there's also the enforcement side of things. What do you think about Joe's concerns about corporate tax enforcement in particular?
Joe focuses on a key problem, that the IRS has been outgunned by corporations and wealthy business owners who have complicated returns, and the IRS just can't deal with them. The Biden administration pledged as part of the legislative process that the enforcement dollars would target large corporations and wealthy individuals and not target those making less than $400,000. Now, mind you, that pledge not to target those making less than $400,000 is a hard one to abide by because sometimes people report very little income and they might have $800,000. Of taxable income, but they've hit out. And so there's a little gloss on the Biden pledge to sort of look at historic levels and to do some nuanced massaging of who might yet be in that higher income range. But for sure, Joe flags the key issue. What do we do about these large corporations, wealthy businesses, rich individuals, who effectively are audit-proof because the IRS can't figure out how to audit them?
Thanks for the call, Joe, at 800-642-1234. Before I go back to our caller, Steve, you wrote a recent piece for the Washington Post looking at the release of former President Trump's tax information. And you write in that piece, there are things in those tax filings that show a need for more of this kind of enforcement of wealthier individuals and corporations.
Well, I think the biggest takeaway from Trump's taxes is that the IRS struggled to audit him. In the 6 years that the committee asked for Trump's tax returns, in the first presidential year, only one agent was assigned to the task. And he was so overwhelmed that he basically outsourced the initial take on whether the income and deductions were correct to Trump's own tax preparers, Trump's accountants and lawyers, agent reasoning that these were reputable people and that the agent didn't have the resources to look at each of Trump's deductions. And so it got a little better in the latter couple of years in that there were a couple more agents assigned, three more agents assigned to the task. But throughout this period, we saw an IRS that was basically outgunned by President Trump. Part of the problem is Trump has had a particularly complicated and sprawling empire. And so just trying to get your arms around that was very hard. Of course, on the other side, people have wondered how Trump pays so little taxes, at least as reported by the New York Times. Year after year, Trump reports zero or negative income and pays trivial amounts of taxes. From 1985 to 2018, he had either zero or negative income. People have wondered about that. And you might have thought as president, the IRS would take a closer look as part of the presidential audit program, but they didn't. They didn't follow their own manual to conduct an expedited or even a comprehensive audit as best we can see.
We're talking to Stephen Rosenthal, senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. We're looking at funding for the IRS after House Republicans recently voted to cut recently added funding for the agency. That change unlikely at this point to pass in the Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how the IRS works, how this funding affects it, what's at stake if it were to be removed? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Stephen Rosenthal, senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. House Republicans voted this week to rescind tens of billions of dollars from IRS funding that Congress passed last year. We're looking at what the IRS is using that funding for, what losing it might mean for the agency and for federal revenue. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Dan is with us in La Crescent, Minnesota. Dan, hi.
Hi. I just have a comment. Thanks for taking my call. I find it interesting that Republicans want to defund the police when it's the kind of police that go after their rich friends for cheating on their taxes.
Dan, thanks for the call. Steve, it's not a complete defunding, but it's a rescinding recent funding. Do you think there's a comparison there?
So, look, I really struggle with the Republican demonization of the IRS. I think the prior caller flagged the fact that we all rely on taxes that the government raises to pay for the services we demand. As Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, taxes are what we pay for a civilized society. And I think the notion of beating up on the IRS and demonizing IRS employees tends to cause the IRS to perform worse, attract fewer people. And the consequence is some of the people calling for the initial cuts use that as an excuse to cut even further. Look, we need to punish the IRS because it fell down on the job. There was a slippage. That cycle has been going on since 2010, when the Republicans last took control of the House of Representatives and started gutting the IRS. It happened over the last 12 years or so until Congress replenished a lot of the IRS resources with this $80 billion. In real terms, the dollar IRS budget fell by 23%, and the enforcement budget fell by 26%. That's a real problem, and I think the Democrats tried to take steps to reverse that cycle and that decline. Unfortunately, the first legislative act that the new Republican-controlled House did was to rescind almost all of the $80 billion. I think it's absurd. I get the talking point, beating up on the IRS, is an easy target, but I think we need more serious politicians to tackle the problems our country faces, including raising the money to pay for the services that we all rely upon.
Thanks for the call, Dan. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I always pay my taxes and I always vote, so I have a right to an opinion on this topic. I'm curious. I understand our total deficit is over $22 trillion now. I may be wrong. But I wonder what the budget is for the Department of Revenue, the IRS, and what percentage of the money they collect actually goes into the U.S. Treasury. I wonder if you can tell me that. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Steve?
Well, there's a difference between the deficit and the debt, and $22 trillion sounds more like the national debt.
Right, yeah.
As far as the annual deficit, I've forgotten whether it's like $300-400 billion a year now. And as far as the IRS share of the overall budget that's spent every year, again, I don't have those numbers at my fingers. It's certainly sizable, but the money that the IRS raises is spent across the whole government. The IRS does not use its revenue to support just the IRS, but supports like our environment, environmental protection and cleanup, our defense system, various social programs. And so the IRS is not using the money just for itself. Interestingly, if we applied a cost-benefit analysis, I think for every dollar that we give the IRS to enforce the tax laws, we get something like $12 or $13 back. Now, that's not the right measurement that it's profitable to give money to the IRS, because of course it imposes a burden on the taxpayers who have to provide information to the IRS and deal with requests from the IRS. But still, you could see the IRS is a profitable enterprise. It's just a necessary service in my mind.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Ron joins us now in Thiensville. Ron, hi.
Hi there. My question is, you ever try to call the IRS? Well, you can stay on the phone forever, and you'll never talk to anybody. There's nobody there. And if you have a little problem going and you get a letter and you kind of write back and this and that and the other thing, it takes you about a month or a month and a half between every communication, and you can't have any specific person to talk to. So defunding the IRS is ridiculous. And the fact is, it's what I think it is, it's just a big little green light for the tax cheaters. And they'll say, and it's great for those folks, but for the people, that honest people that want to pay their taxes and have questions, you're in trouble.
Ron, thanks for the call. Ron, as we were talking earlier, Steve, not alone facing that backlog. We've covered that a little bit. Ron worried, though, that less funding, fewer audits, he says, a green light potentially for tax cheats.
Right. When we collect fewer taxes from those who try to hide their income, that shifts more taxes to those who comply with the tax law. And so beating up on the IRS and making it easier for rich people and others to hide their taxes mean the rest of us pay more. I would just point out one tip. There is a taxpayer advocate out there that if one of your listeners gets stuck trying to reach the IRS, oddly enough, a decade or so ago, we added this taxpayer advocate office to help taxpayers deal with the IRS. I personally might have just wanted more money for IRS service representatives to answer phone calls, but we now have an additional layer of advocacy as another solution.
Thanks for that call, Ron. Keith is with us now in Minneapolis. Keith, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to make a comment that's consistent with what your guest is saying. All those middle, low-income taxpayers whose primary income is wage and salary income, they're paying 100% of the tax due on that income because that income is reported to the IRS. And if it doesn't show up on their tax return, the IRS easily catches that due to the fact that the employer has already reported that income. It's all the non-documented sources of income, sales of assets, some stocks, and other items that are never caught. And that's the sort of income that primarily is earned by very affluent persons, which frankly I am, but the taxpaying public just doesn't seem to get it.
Keith, thanks for the call. Steve, what do you think?
Keith is right. The average worker's taxes are open and shut. They get a W-2, so does the IRS. They get a 1099 reporting their interest and investment income, so does the IRS. 99% of the taxes due are paid. Keith also makes a good point that business owners, especially those in the cash and cash and the new gig economy, their compliance level is really bad. More than half of the income that they receive goes unreported, omitted, for every IRS study over the last couple of decades. That's a real challenge. Although it's funny because there was a dust up. I don't know, Rob, if you saw the new expanded 1099 Ks that would have required PayPal and Venmo to start sending more information reports for commercial transactions. That got a lot of people up in arms because they thought their side gigs would now be reported to the IRS. Their side gigs were always taxable. They were just able to hide the income from the IRS. And I can understand, I'm sympathetic somewhat, like, hey, if you're just, you know, earning a few hundred extra bucks, or a few hundred thousand bucks, a few thousand bucks as a side gig, you know, why make a big deal out of it? But the real problem to think through is every time a dishonest taxpayer omits income, that means the rates are higher for the honest taxpayers in order to collect the taxes that we need. And so we ought to make a fair decision for everybody as to what they owe and then making sure to collect what they owe.
Thanks for that call. Steve, just in our last minute, this House vote probably going to go nowhere in the Senate. Are you concerned, though, that when there is a spending bill, a must-pass spending bill, or a debt ceiling increase, we might be revisiting this conversation about cutting this funding again?
Yes, Rob, I'm very concerned by that. On its own, the Senate will not rescind the $80 billion. However, these House Republicans are very agitated, and they've threatened to hold the global economy hostage and our domestic budget hostage unless they get what they want. And so there's a big question as to if the Republicans hold the debt ceiling hostage, not lifting the debt ceiling for prior obligations that have already been committed by Congress. If they don't lift that, then the full faith and credit of the U.S. government may fail, the global economy may fail. And so we'll have to see how that scenario plays out. The House Republicans adopted as a rule that they must demand spending cuts as part of the increasing the debt ceiling. Biden has announced that he's not going to give any concessions as part of the increase of the debt ceiling. So at the moment, we're on a collision course.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Stephen Rosenthal, senior fellow with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Joined us to talk about the state of funding for the IRS, what it needs, what it's getting, what House Republicans this week voted in favor of taking away. Coming up, a Wisconsin doctor tells us about a new drug approved by the FDA to help slow cognitive decline in early stages of Alzheimer's. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to one of the organizers of a Menominee Nation project to reintroduce bison to their land and their culture. Now, the Food and Drug Administration approved a new drug for treating early stages of Alzheimer's that would help slow cognitive decline. The new drug, called lecanemab, will be sold under the name Leqembi. The FDA pointed to research showing the drug could help with cognitive decline, brain function, and overall quality of life for people living with Alzheimer's, but there are some serious potential side effects and a heavy price tag. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you or someone you know has Alzheimer's, are you hopeful that a drug like this could make a difference? Have you experienced other Alzheimer's medications as a patient, a loved one thereof, a healthcare provider? What was the experience like? What questions do you have about this drug and Alzheimer's treatment and prevention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Nate Chin is a geriatrician at UW Health and medical director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also medical director of the RAP study. Dr. Chin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Before we get to this particular drug, as I understand it, Alzheimer's, we don't have a lot of treatments available. It's a difficult-to-treat disease. What is the state of the art out there when it comes to Alzheimer's treatment before these new drugs come along?
Well, when we think of medication treatments, we have two classes of drugs that are really meant to address symptoms. So they do not address the underlying disease that is Alzheimer's disease, and they reduce the frequency of symptoms. Now, there was an approval in 2021 of a drug called aducanumab or Aduhelm, which was the first ever that was approved to address the actual process of Alzheimer's, which is this protein called amyloid protein. And that drug removed it very much like lecanemab does.
Does removing these amyloids help with the progression of Alzheimer's?
Well, that's really the main question, Rob, and that's really what the science is looking at. And it's been a very hotly debated topic for many years now. The aducanumab, there's other drugs like it. These are called monoclonal antibodies. And certainly lecanemab would argue that by removing amyloid protein, there are what we call downstream effects, positive changes that happen that reduce the buildup of other proteins or other processes that lead to thinking changes. So possibly this is quite meaningful.
Okay, so here's this new drug, lecanemab. What, first of all, is the promise? What kind of positive results were we seeing in the trials on this medication?
So the most recent trial, this is a phase three trial of about 1,800 people. Those that were on it showed a 27% reduced decline based on a validated research slash clinical tool called the Clinical Dementia Rating Scale. And so 20% slowing of decline. So it's not stopping progression, it's not curing or reversing decline, it is slowing the rate at which someone is experiencing changes.
And this is at the early stages of Alzheimer's. So what are we looking at in terms of diagnosing a patient and saying, yes, the timing is right, this might be an appropriate drug?
I appreciate that question because as a person in a memory clinic, it's really hard to actually diagnose Alzheimer's disease. We diagnose the experience, the syndrome of thinking change. And so when someone says early Alzheimer's disease, what they're really meaning is someone who's been diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment or MCI or mild stage dementia. And in dementia, a person has a functional day-to-day activity change. And so those two stages are what they're referring to. And when they say Alzheimer's, they're saying that this protein is present or the clinician strongly suspects that Alzheimer's disease is causing mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia.
Well, now there are other causes of dementia, right? How do we decide we're sure enough that this is Alzheimer's to use something that targets these amyloids associated with Alzheimer's?
This idea of multiple etiology dementia or multiple etiology cognitive impairment is a really important factor in this. And so the presence of having amyloid protein and tau protein really confer this diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And so, well, in the trial, they used an amyloid PET scan or spinal fluid, which can happen clinically. Spinal fluid is much easier to obtain and do. But those are the ways that we identify the actual process of Alzheimer's disease, or actually say that a person has Alzheimer's disease. There are other things that we can do to rule out other potential causes, such as vascular disease, which is very common, and that's through an MRI scan. Clinicians, astute neurologists, geriatricians, psychiatrists, primary care providers can certainly evaluate for things like Parkinson's disease or a similar condition called Lewy body disease. But there isn't a very concrete way of identifying those. We call these biomarkers. There's not really a blood test or a scan that can confirm that. And so there's always a little bit of uncertainty as to the presence of other potential conditions when even talking about Alzheimer's disease.
We're talking to Dr. Nate Chin, geriatrician at UW Health, medical director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Looking at this newly approved drug, the FDA signed off on it to treat early Alzheimer's to help reduce cognitive decline. It's headline news because, as we just heard, there aren't a lot of treatments like this. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your hopes for this or other medications, your experiences, maybe your own, your family, or if you're a healthcare provider, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Chin, we talked about the positives here, the reduction in the rate of cognitive decline in early Alzheimer's with this new medication. People have raised concerns about some of the side effects. What are those concerns?
Well, the main one that we hear about and certainly read about is something called ARIA, A-R-I-A, and that just is an acronym for amyloid-related imaging abnormality. It's a mouthful, which is why we often call it ARIA. And what we know is that these medications, these monoclonal antibodies, they tend to have this radiographic, this imaging result where people can either have swelling or fluid called effusion, so ARIA-E, or they can have small bleeding in the brain called ARIA-H. And so this, in the first drug, aducanumab, this was really a hotly debated part of the conversation because the risks were quite high. The ARIA that was present was in larger numbers. With lecanemab, we at least based on the phase 3 studies, it seems to be present, but at lower percentages. So just for example, being on the medication, 12.6% of people had ARIA-E, the effusion, versus 1.7% that were on the placebo. Of those that had it, most of them did not actually have symptoms and so didn't need to change the medication. But those that did experienced real problems, headaches, visual disturbances, confusion. The bleeding is the one that really makes the news because nobody wants to have bleeding in the brain. And so certainly that was present in the medication. When it was just looking purely at bleeding, it was about 9% of people who were on lecanemab versus just about 8% of people who were on the placebo. But that means that even people not on the drug were still having some of these bleeding events. But it's still significant enough that we have to discuss this. We have to really look at who's at risk of developing those bleeds and who do we need to potentially not use this medication with.
And this medication, not cheap, a 5-digit price tag for a year of treatment, I think, and not easy to use. You have to go in, I believe, to a clinic, and this is something that is injected or in an IV?
Correct. And in fact, it's not even a clinic. It's an infusion. So imagine chemotherapy. You're going into an infusion center where you're being hooked up to an IV line. And for a period of time, you're receiving this medication. And so it's every other week or roughly twice a month that you go in for this period of time. And there's an infusion center cost, there's staff costs, there's imaging that goes with it. So that price tag that you may read about, that's really just for the price of the medication. It's not really including all of the other things that go with it, especially the MRI scans. And in the study, they had 5 MRI scans. As long as you didn't have symptoms, they had 5 MRI scans just to be on, just while you're on this drug.
Wow. Okay. So this is the tough part of medicine, and not that there's easy parts, but we've got these benefits in terms of slowing down cognitive decline. We've got the side effects we've talked about. We've got this high price tag. How do we decide this patient is going to benefit for this drug? It's going to outweigh the risks and the costs.
Well, I mean, that's the tough question, and that's certainly something that the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, and Medicare are going to be weighing in on. They're going to have to determine the risk-benefit, cost-benefit analysis of this. And I think really at the heart of this question is something that's been really nagging at the field, which is what is clinical meaningfulness? What is it that we will define as this is worth that risk? And I think that's a subjective question. Each person really has to consider that themselves, but from a public health or institutional perspective, you know, what is it that we're going to say is meaningful? I told you 27% reduced decline, and our statisticians have been able to say, well, that's roughly 4 to 6 months of prolonging a person at their current state. So if you're in mild cognitive impairment, you will be in that stage for 4 to 6 months longer, or in mild stage dementia. I mean, to many people, Rob, that would be very significant and worth the cost. And so it's something that really has to be discussed.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. I just, my mother had Alzheimer's disease later in life, and I thought I heard on the radio or one of the media about some new study, memory study, for those that thought they might have some memory impairment. I wonder if the doctor knows anything about that.
John, thanks for the call. Dr. Chin, I assume this kind of study is going on around the country all the time. Are there any studies you have your eye on that might be recruiting people, especially to look at the progression of memory impairment?
I mean, you're right, Rob. There are many studies happening, even including here in Madison, Wisconsin. You mentioned the ADRC and RAP. These are longitudinal observational studies. And so people who are cognitively healthy but at risk, maybe they have a family history, they can come in and we assess them on a yearly or biannual, so every other year basis, where we do tests and we watch them and we do these lumbar punctures and PET scans to see how the brain is aging. But also, and perhaps this is what John is referring to, there is this incredible study called the AHEAD study. And this is a national, it could even be an international study, where they're using the same drug. So this is lecanemab. They're using this drug, but in people who do not have impairment on testing, they most likely either don't have symptoms or just subtle symptoms, but they also have amyloid in their brain. And so in Madison, Dr. Cindy Carlson, who is our clinical trials director and one of my colleagues in the ADRC, she's leading this study. So people are receiving the same medication, same dose, but we're seeing if ideally, if you can prevent or delay the onset of symptoms. And this is for everyone in the Wisconsin area, whether you're from Green Bay or Milwaukee, you could potentially come to Madison to receive this therapy. Now, it's randomized controlled, meaning some people receive a placebo, but this is the idea that can we get to people even before they develop symptoms with these types of drugs?
John, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Dr. Nate Chin, geriatrician at UW Health, medical director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Looking at this new drug used to help with cognitive decline for early Alzheimer's, just approved by the FDA, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about these? A couple now new medications on the market, the benefits, the potential risks and costs, or about treatment and prevention of Alzheimer's in general? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Dr. Nate Chin, geriatrician at UW Health, medical director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, looking at a new medication just approved by the FDA, aimed at helping slow down decline in the early stages of Alzheimer's. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What else do you want to know about lecanemab, this new medication, or wider questions, concerns, experiences maybe with Alzheimer's prevention and treatment? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now with Bill on the line in Milwaukee. Bill, hello.
Good afternoon, everybody. I have a friend. In fact, he's my best friend. He's 84 years old. He's becoming very forgetful. I don't suspect Alzheimer's. Sometimes I wonder if he might have a kind of dementia. I don't know. How do you get your friends in to check on these things to see if they need help? Because I think a lot of times he doesn't remember because he's not really paying attention.
Bill, thanks for the call. Dr. Chin, I think this is a pretty common question that people might ask about themselves or someone they know. How do we distinguish, you know, I'm just not remembering stuff lately, from this is an early sign of some form of dementia?
It's a great question, and I appreciate Bill's concern and the fact that he has identified something that he wants to talk to his friend about. And I think that's ultimately what it comes down to. You want to share with the person that you care and that you're noticing some changes. And I would start by actually observing and possibly recording, meaning just writing down some of these changes. And I say that because denial is very powerful. And when you tell someone, or even if it's a loved one, a family member, that there are changes, their initial reaction is going to be, no, that's not true, or there are other reasons for that. And it's nice to be able to say, well, I've observed these things, and this is why I'm concerned. And after that conversation, where they know that you're coming from a good place, it would be nice for that person to go speak to their primary care provider to be able to share these things. Also, potentially to have what we call cognitive screening, a thinking test that maybe takes about 10 minutes. And that would tell you that you have a disease. It wouldn't tell you that you have for sure impairment, but it would tell you how your brain is overall performing. And I think the reason that's so important is that there are so many things that can affect our thinking that are not Alzheimer's disease, that are not vascular disease or Parkinson's disease. You could have bad sleep, persistent bad sleep. You could be in a bad mood. It could be a medication side effect. You could have sleep apnea. There are lots of things that we can identify and treat that can be reversed or at least improve a person's symptoms and well-being that are not diseases of the brain. But we can't ever get to that if people are fearful of coming in. And that's the stigma of Alzheimer's and dementias. And we really have to work past that by talking to the people we care about.
Bill, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Chin, I wanted to ask about prevention of Alzheimer's. Given that our treatment options are still fairly limited, are we making progress in knowing the kinds of things we can do to prevent it occurring in the first place?
And this is really where the field is moving. And I would say, if I could step a little bit further back and not speak specifically to Alzheimer's disease, but say that roughly 40% of dementias are felt to be reversible. And there's this Lancet Commission, and people wanted to Google Lancet. They have come out with known risk factors. And some of these risk factors make sense to us. These are things being inactive, smoking, hearing loss, traumatic brain injury, but even things like environmental pollution. These are things that we think can actually be addressed and prevent the development of dementia, which is sort of this big umbrella term. Alzheimer's disease is harder, and that's why we need to study people over a long period of time to understand what the risk factors are. We certainly speak to, and if anyone ever listens to my podcast, Dementia Matters, they hear me talking about, well, there are really brain healthy habits, exercise, diet, sleep, stress reduction, being social, mentally stimulated activities. These are things that we do believe make an impact. Perhaps they don't prevent it, but they certainly can help the brain function to the best of its ability.
Talking to Dr. Nate Chin from UW Health and the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, looking at a new Alzheimer's medication to help reduce cognitive decline in the early stages of the disease and other things related to treatment and prevention of Alzheimer's. Let's go back to your calls now. Rodney is with us in Prior Lake, Minnesota. Rodney, hello.
Hello. How are you guys doing this afternoon?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Rodney?
Jay, I just caught the tail end, and thank you so much for taking my call. I guess, you know, for both of you, maybe even definitely towards you, Dr. Chin. So here's the background. My father-in-law has recently been diagnosed with, you know, early onset for Alzheimer's. And ever since the summer is when my wife, his daughter, and his other daughter have really gotten involved trying to, you know, get next steps, healthcare, power of attorney, just kind of things like that kind of set in place. And we have noticed quite a dramatic decline just with a lot of his short-term memory, you know, sometimes driving abilities, especially at night, you know, later in the day when, you know, just he's getting fatigued, things like that. And his girlfriend has really, you know, spearheaded a lot of, like, the doctor visits and consults, so I don't have a lot of the information, unfortunately, to share with you. I know a lot of them have been more like the naturopathic way. I know he has a very restrictive diet as far as what he can and cannot eat, reducing a lot of, you know, no more diet sodas and eliminating a lot of sugars, things like that. So my question is, what would you recommend for myself, for my father-in-law, as far as, you know, again, this particular medication that I'm just learning about sounds very intriguing as we continue to do more research.
I gotcha, Rodney. We don't have a lot of time left, Dr. Chin. In that situation, if Rodney was interested in trying to see, hey, is this medication right for his father-in-law? How does a patient or a family member get started on that?
It's a great question, and I appreciate Rodney and his support of his wife, who is a caregiver to the father-in-law, and that's critical. So being supportive is probably the best thing you can do when thinking about, well, how do I know if I'm appropriate? We really need a diagnosis. And so I would encourage Rodney to create that team of that family, those family members, get a diagnosis. Is this mild cognitive impairment? Is this dementia? If it's dementia, is this mild stage? Those are the two stages in which this medication may be appropriate. And then once that is known, is amyloid present in the brain? Because this medication can only remove amyloid in the brain. So if you don't have amyloid, the medication isn't going to be helpful. And so knowing those two things first is going to be absolutely critical. Although I would still say all the advanced care planning that Rodney's wife and sister have been doing is absolutely essential too.
Thanks for the call, Rodney. In just our last few moments, Dr. Chin, what are you watching for in the field of Alzheimer's treatment?
You know, I would say that I'm looking for more studies to be done on diverse populations. I'm looking for more studies to be done even earlier than what we're seeing. And I'm looking for the combination of not only medications, but those lifestyle factors that we all can engage in right now. So in the end, it's like, because there's multiple things happening in the brain, there's multiple different pathways of Alzheimer's disease. It's not going to be one drug. It's going to be multiple drugs in the context of a certain lifestyle that is the healthiest possible. And I do believe the field is moving in that direction. These are conversations that are happening right now. Certainly, lecanemab is a game changer in a lot of ways, but I think this is really the beginning of a new effort in clinical research.
Dr. Chin, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Dr. Nate Chin, geriatrician at UW Health, medical director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about a new medication approved by the FDA aimed at helping with cognitive decline in early Alzheimer's. You can also follow Dr. Chin's work and a lot of the latest news with the Dementia Matters podcast about Alzheimer's disease. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the English language has a lot of unique turns of phrase. Find out where they came from, how their meanings have changed over the years with the author of the book, Take My Word for It, A Dictionary of English Idioms. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Speaking of turns of phrase, there's a new list of words and phrases that are banned for 2023. Not officially, of course. Lake Superior State University in Michigan's Upper Peninsula kicked off the new year with its annual Banished Words List. Every year, they suggest we avoid using some words and phrases that have become overused, misused, useless, or just generally annoying. Some highlights from the new list: GOAT, as in greatest of all time. Inflection point, I've seen that in news articles. They say it's just a pretentious way to say turning point. Moving forward, as in something happening in the future. Yeah, I always kill that one in radio scripts when I find it. And the question, does that make sense? When used in the midst of conversations, they say it's overused, usually unnecessary. They've been doing this list for years. This one could be the GOAT. I will try to avoid these phrases moving forward. Does that make sense? This is Central Time.